What's up, everybody? My name is Mike Lee, and I would like to welcome you to the Mind Shift Lab. Each episode will bring you a new guest to share some exercises, strategies, and mindsets to help you create an internal shift that drives external results in business, the arts, sports, and life. Today, we are diving in with John Foley. John is a former lead solo pilot of the Blue Angels, Sloan Fellow at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, entrepreneur, venture capitalist, leadership expert, speaker, and gratitude guru. As a thought leader on high performance, John created the Glad to Be Here mindset methodology and the Diamond Performance Framework. One of the most in-demand leadership and performance experts, John has spoken on 5 continents, in 20 countries, and at over 1,000 events, working with some of the top organizations in the world, such as Google, Mercedes-Benz, and Marriott. As a founder of the Glad to Be Here Foundation, he and his wife Carol have donated over $1.9 million to charities worldwide and sponsored 47 children throughout the world. John, thank you so much for being here today. It's good to see you.
Hey, Mike, glad to be here. And you know that saying means a lot to me, both as a Blue Angel and today.
We'll get into that for sure. Yeah. You have done a lot in your life. And if I read off your entire bio, I'd probably take up the entire podcast. So I would love to know and kick this off by asking you, who is the most influential person in your life and what did they teach you along the way to help you get to where you are at today?
You know, it's no doubt my dad. I mean, my dad, when I think about, you know, the words integrity, when I think about the words character, I just picture my dad's face. And I remember he was always there for me. He was present. So my dad was an Army officer and he was an engineer. And I remember growing up, every 3 years, we moved to a new location. I grew up in West Point, New York, Virginia, the Pentagon, all these places, California, where I went to high school. But the bottom line is, you know, he taught me wisdom, right? I mean, I learned from him so much. And I think, you know, my mom also, she gave me love and my dad gave me wisdom. They both had both of those, but the combination made it so where I felt like I could do anything. I had their support.
Do you have any stories about your dad? Something that he taught you when you're growing up that has stuck with you till today?
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. One is he used to call me Champ all the time. So he had a nickname for me. And I think it was reinforcing. And I remember as a kid, we were in West Point and they were having these races, you know, and I was probably 5 years old. I can't remember. And my dad's like, hey, buddy, you know, he also called me buddy. He says, go in the race, you know, and I was a typical scared kid. I'm like, no, you know, I'm not going to go. And he could not get me into it. And then finally he went to go get a beer. And I looked over there and I saw one person, my friend of mine. And I said, you know what, if he's in there, I can do it. And you know, Mike, I ended up winning that race. And I was like, whoa, winning's kind of fun. So I entered the next race. And it taught me something about fear, you know, overcoming fear and just going for it. And I think that's been a lesson for me the rest of my life.
That's so interesting that you bring that up, because I've never thought about that before around a nickname that you can maybe give your kid when they're younger, right? And how much that impacts them probably at a subconscious level. You know, you went right to the point about how much you enjoyed winning and tying that to your dad calling you champ all the time and really probably was something that instilled some confidence in you to always be competing and take risks in your life, which obviously has been something that you have that you've done along the way. So you went from being a lead solo pilot with the Blue Angels to now speaking to organizations across the world. Like, how did you go from that to where you're at today?
You know, Mike, I never planned it. So when I was the lead solo pilot of Blue Angels, that was in the early 90s. I was a career Navy guy. I loved flying jets off aircraft carriers. And that was going to be my path, right? And then about, 3 years later, I'd gone to the Naval War College. And then I got selected for Stanford Business School. And I'm there and I'm going, holy cow, there's a whole world out here that I never knew about. you know? And I always had this bug about being an entrepreneur. Mike, I couldn't even spell it, but I liked the bug, right? And I said, I need to learn that. Well, guess what? That was in the late 90s. And you remember Silicon Valley was just the hotbed of stuff going, and it was just a whole new world. So I ended up saying, you know, I think I'll work a little bit in private equity, venture capital. I got that opportunity. And then there was a big bust. Remember the internet bubble right around 2000? And I was, you know, on the inner circle of a VC firm, and a thought hit my head, you know, how come? But the how come was not why'd the bubble burst. It was how come some people outperform others and some don't? How come some teams consistently outperform others? Some organizations can consistently outperform others and some don't. And that's been my quest for the last two decades, Mike, is working with world-class organizations all around the world, whether it's in, you know, technology, Silicon Valley, whether it's in financial services on Wall Street, whether it's in New Delhi, India, all over the world, and just learning like crazy. And what I found, Mike, was I just simply re-engineered what some of the high-performance teams I was on, specifically the Blue Angels, and I said, wait a minute, how do you lead through change? How do you sustain excellence? How do you get people to actually raise their game? What does teamwork really mean? What does it mean to have that trust where you can fly 18 inches from another airplane? And most importantly, how can that be related back to the business world? So that's been the journey, Mike. I never planned it.
So you're working with a lot of people right now in high performance. What does that mean to you? And like, what are some steps, if people want to level up, like what are some steps that they can put into place today to be able to do that?
Well, for me, it's what glad to be here stands for. And to me, glad to be here was a phrase that we used on the Blue Angels during our debriefs. And that whole concept of debrief, I think, is while it's the civilian world, you know, we understand the concept. People don't do it like we used to do it on the Blue Angels. So it's a combination of operational excellence, or what I call a cadence of execution, which for me is I show the briefs and the debriefs. So the preparation before an event, the level of focus and clarity, then the alignment that happens within a team. But then you have to have that debrief, which is what did I learn, right? What did we learn from this event? And that cadence of execution, I think, has to be wrapped into what I call a glad to be here mindset, which is appreciation and gratitude. So rarely does a company have both. Usually they have one or the other. But when you bring those two together, you have breakthrough performance, and that's really the secret sauce.
Why is that? Can you get into some of the science behind it, or a story about how somebody went from not implementing this to implementing this and their performance getting to another level?
Yeah, so most of the companies I work with fall into one of two categories, right? They either are entrepreneurial, they're fast moving, they make decisions quickly, or they're a bigger, more established organization that has a lot of structure and a lot of process, but usually is slow to change and adapt. And what I realized was you need to have both. Right? And that's the struggle. The entrepreneurial, the startup companies, they have all these visions, these dreams that people are passionate about it, but it's hard to scale. It's hard to get that beyond. And you know, even with my company right now, we're starting to scale in a big way. And it's because I need the process and structure to fall into line with the vision. And what I really like to talk about, Mike, is that it's really not about vision anymore. It's about commitment and buy-in to a vision, right? So we as leaders, it's all about how do you get people committed? How do you get people bought in to the concept, right? Then you got to have a cadence of execution. I like to go to the brief next. To me, the brief is sequential, process, planning, but it's really more about focus, right? And I love to talk about gratitude here, and we'll get into the science behind gratitude. But the third step is an alignment process. So that's where the center point comes in. And again, I like to show the jets coming at each other, 1,000 miles per hour closer. You know, how do we align at that dynamic environment? The execution is through high trust. So we got to build high trust contracts. And then we tap in this debrief process. And what I realize when people get exposed to that, Mike, first you got to paint the picture. They get it right away. And then they find out, well, where are they strong and where are they weak? Because usually every company will be either strong or weak in certain areas. Rarely do you see all those clicking. And then the secret sauce, though, is having this glad to be here mindset. that is about appreciation and gratitude. So here's the science on that. So it turns out the area of your brain that lights up when you are in a grateful state of mind, okay, is the same area of your brain where perceptions come from. So how we perceive the world, Mike, is actually coming from us, not at us. And how others perceive us then is also affected by that. And then it turns out that when you are in a generous state of mind, all right, that area of your brain that lights up is the same area of your brain where confidence comes from. So you combine those two, and when you're in a grateful state of mind and an appreciative state of mind, you see things others don't see, your perceptions, and you have the confidence to take action. That's transformation. That's innovation. That's what's changing the world.
So one of the things you brought up was building high trust teams.
Yeah.
I feel like right now there's a massive amount of mistrust in our world, from just general life to business space. What are some things that leaders can do right now in order to cultivate more of that trust?
Yeah, so first thing, it's connect, right? And that's what we're all trying to do. We're trying to reestablish those deep connections that we had pre-COVID. You know, I mean, you know, this kind of interaction is great because we can see each other, we're talking, but in person's even better, right? Because you can feel a person and you can get that. So that's why, you know, we're seeing a huge request now to do live events, because people want to connect and leaders need to connect with their people. That's the first step. After connection, you need to get alignment though. It's one thing to be connected. It's a whole nother thing to be aligned. And then the third piece is the execution piece. And that's where the trust comes in. And the way I'd answer your question is, it's what Gandhi said a long time ago, be the change you want to see in the world. So if we're not seeing high trust in our organization, in our relationships, we got to start. We're looking inward first.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, is that we look at leadership as all the external things. And if you just, the power of modeling and demonstrating behaviors is so huge. And if we would just focus on what is probably the hardest thing, not probably, it definitely is the hardest thing, which is leading yourself first every day. It has a compounding effect on everybody else that you interact with, that sees you, that is always watching you. Your people are always watching you, especially now, right? Going back to the trust conversation we're having, right? I think that's so crucial to be able to show up every day as the best version of yourself as a leader. What are some things that leaders can do in order to put themselves in a position to do that?
Well, I think what you just said, it's how you show up every day, right? So I have a morning routine,
awesome.
I do this every morning. It starts with a gratitude practice. The very first thing I do when I wake up is I go through, what am I grateful for? And I go present moment. I go back to the past, what happened yesterday. I think of people, like tomorrow morning, I'll be thinking of this. I'll be thinking of this podcast. I'll be thinking of your face. And then I go forward in the day and say, how can I help and serve others in line with what I'm doing, right? And so that gratitude practice really does change the way I see the world. And then I have a physical practice. I get outside right away, and I get my body moving, right? I stand on my head. In fact, I just stood on my head about an hour ago before this, because I reversed the energy in my body. And what it does is, and then I do meditation. I have a meditation practice. And what that does is it prepares me to put my best foot forward. I can respond instead of react to situations. You know, a lot of times something happens and we just react, and I go, wait a minute. You know, let me respond to this. And so I think every leader, every single person, you don't even have to be a leader, but how you show up every day matters. And I think your morning routine is the best way to start that.
How do you think your meditation practice and your exercise and things like that, how does that make you have a better ability to respond versus to react? Like what's actually happening there?
Yeah, so, you know, we'll go meditation first, and then we'll bring in the physical body part there, right? But for me, meditation is just training your mind to watch itself, but also to be able to observe the situation and not feel that you're actually having to react, right? So I call it situational awareness when I was in the airplane, right? So I'm flying the jet and I'm situationally aware. I'm looking at what's the big picture, you know, where's the obstacles, that is there a sailboat mast in the way, is a building over here? And then our human brain has the ability to focus down. And that's where I'm seeing my opposing solo come at me at 1,000 miles per hour closer. And I can actually see the nose movement of that airplane. And so the human brain has this amazing capability to focus down and open up, focus down and open up, the macro micro way. And meditation helps train your brain to be aware that that's happening and to actually take more positive control of that, which is critical in any situation, because if you stay too focused down, you're going to miss something. If you stay too wide, you're not going to capture that execution that you need. So number one, that's what meditation does for me. It's training my brain. By the way, you don't have to have eyes closed and sitting cross-legged to meditate. You know, we have this visualization process we did on the Blue Angels where we were visualizing the outcome of the air show well before it actually happened. And you know this in sports teams, you know extremely well the power of that visualization. And then the second piece is, I think you need to be, you know, the mind and body are connected. So for me, that physical movement, that ability to get the conscious brain aligned with my physical body, they play back and forth. So I do a lot of yoga. I stand on my head. I actually do a seal workout every morning. And the combination of the two, I think, is what's powerful.
Awesome. And you're doing all that before you start interacting with the rest of the world, right?
Yeah, and that's a choice, right? So you have to carve out some space in your day. And so, you know, those times will vary, because sometimes I have early morning meetings and that means I just got to get up an hour earlier, right? And I can do it in about 15 minutes. I mean, I've got it down to where I can do about a 4-minute gratitude practice. I can do about a 7-minute exercise practice, and then, you know, a meditation practice in there. I can be ready in 20 minutes. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You need to carve out that time.
Awesome. So how would you advise somebody to balance beliefs and confidence? And so what I mean by that is, there's so many times that people are, I know one of your big pieces of your philosophy is elevating beliefs, right? And I think so many times people are afraid to take that first step or the second step or the third step because they don't have confidence yet. And we're conditioned by our culture to not act until we have confidence, when it's actually the other way around. It's the action that builds the confidence, right? So where does belief fall into that? And how do you balance holding the belief that something is possible, yet taking the action over and over and over again to be able to build that sustained confidence?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's two sides to the same coin, right? What you're talking about is this ability to take action, but not necessarily know the outcome, you know? On the other hand, to actually raise your beliefs or have your beliefs. So what I found is, very simply, I had someone tell me this once. It was another speaker and I really connected with it. His name was Lou Tice. He basically said that your belief can't be so far out there that you can't see yourself getting there. So it's more of a stair-stepped approach, right? So have those stair-stepped approaches where, yeah, I need to believe I could do this. I might not know how to do it now. I might not be at that level of competency that's world class, but I'm going to learn as I grow, right? As I do it. So to me, it's those step goals. But I would say, you know, a good example is, we just launched a new website. In fact, you ought to check it out. It just went live a couple of days ago, right? And that was a process, right? And I remember in that process, like any, you know, technology, you know, release, at some point, you just got to call it quits. You say, you know, it's good enough right now. Let's get it out there to the world, because you can be tweaking things forever. And then you get it out to the world and you realize, oh, okay, you know, we got a little glitch here. Let's fix it. And let's, you know, add another video here and that kind of stuff. So to me, that's that balance. I'll be honest with you, I'm more of a perfectionist. And so I really want it to look really good before I release it. And I'm finding that I got to challenge myself to just get out there, try it, and then learn from it.
100%. I think the funny thing is like, even with that website being complete, right? Will it ever get to the point where it's perfect, right? The process of going after something, just like building the perfect website or building the perfect business or whatever it is, it's always an iterative process. And I think when we can focus on the growth versus the end result, it actually sets ourselves up to getting to that end result in a way that is probably going to be more efficient and faster to get there, because at the end of the day, focusing on the end result is not what is going to drive the outcomes. Speaking of that, what are some of the common traits of people that you have worked with that are consistently delivering world-class results?
You know, the first one that comes to my mind is giving. All right. They're very giving of their, you know, time. That's just their highest resource, of their knowledge, of their wisdom. They're sharing, like you and I, you know, we talk all the time. Hey, how's it look over there? You know, what are you seeing? What am I seeing? And so sharing and giving is, to me, the most important trait. And then the second one is a thirst to learn. You know, they just want to learn. Like, I'm constantly, the reason I listen to so many podcasts and do my own, which is, by the way, you've been on it, the High Performance Zone, right? That podcast is to learn. You know, I'm learning from you. I'm learning from everybody. And then the third piece is the growth that takes place from that learning. And that's where the action comes in, and we actually repeat the cycle. So that's actually a mantra for me. Learn, grow, give. And then I realized I had the order wrong. It starts with giving. So give, learn, and grow. And I actually, I repeat that to myself every day.
Interesting. That's something that, I wouldn't say that I follow those steps, but I feel like a lot of things that I do in my life is, I got this problem in my life that I got to solve. I'm going to learn how to overcome it and then teach somebody else how to do the same thing, right? Yeah. And so where did you flip that to start giving first instead of learning first?
Yeah, that's a great comment. That came from about the last two decades of spiritual growth. You know, I'm constantly trying to grow in many different ways. And so I've done a lot of readings now in the Eastern traditions, you know. And there's a thing called the six perfections of being a good person, a good human. And the first one is giving. This idea of, if you start with giving, by the way, that's where wealth comes from. It's not the other way around. And I got to be honest with you, I didn't have that correct. You know, years ago, I figured, oh, I'll wait till I make a lot of money, and then, you know, then I can give to charity or I can give these nonprofits. And what I realized, Mike, is it wasn't happening very fast, right? I wasn't making enough money. And finally, I changed my thinking. And I said, wait a minute, why don't I just look forward? And I give now 10% of all my future revenues, so there's no guilt involved in what I have or haven't done, to a charity. And we started a foundation called the Glad to Be Here Foundation. And every client that hires us knows that, you know, 10% of that is going to charity. I let them pick where some of that money goes. So through that experience, I realized how many people out there are doing good things. You know, we've now sponsored over 400 nonprofits around the world. In fact, I just got back from Africa. I was a mule. I carried 12 corneas over to Africa so that a buddy of mine, Jeff Tabin, with the Himalayan Cataract Project, could do the surgeries. And Mike, it was so gratifying to actually be boots on the ground, not just give money, but actually be there and watch people get their eyesight back. It just blows my mind. So yeah, it's been a change in my life.
Let's go to that. What were some of the things that you learned on that journey?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Africa, first off, that you're not allowed to bring human body parts into Tanzania. So I was actually a smuggler. Okay. I was smuggling human body parts in, and I didn't know this until, you know, Jeff, with the Himalayan Cataract Project, they had an official letter. I had to get through TSA. I'm carrying an ice chest full of human eyeballs, right? Through TSA. They won't even let you carry water through. Right. So how the hell are you going to get eyeballs with ice through? Right. You know, I just talked to him, talked to the head guy and said, here's my letter. This is what I'm trying to do. And they were good about it. You know, they did their own special search, but we couldn't open it up. Right. And then, so I was in Amsterdam because I had to fly from, I was leaving Sun Valley going to Amsterdam, and I get a text from my buddy, the doctor. And he says, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you. Yeah. You're not allowed to bring human body parts into the country. So he says, but don't worry about it. He said, just put a newspaper over it. And, whatever you do, don't pay a bribe. I'm like, pay a bribe? Illegal? What are you talking about? You know? And bottom line is it was no problem. You know, I got it through customs. And of course, you know, we saved 12 people's eyesights with that. So it's pretty cool. And then after that, for fun, we climbed Kilimanjaro, which was a fun little hike.
Take me to that. What was there anything that you learned on that journey to the top?
Yeah, well, number one, it's just about teamwork. You know, we had a pretty first-class outfit. There was only 9 of us that were the clients, and they had 54 support staff. So everything from porters to guides, medical, it was incredible what was put together. And everybody had their role, right? And these, you know, I mean, honestly, it wasn't that hard to get to the summit, because we had so much support, right? I mean, I remember the morning we climbed the summit, you have to get acclimated, you know, your body to that. So we would go high and come down and go high and come down. And bottom line is we got up about midnight, 2 a.m., we're hiking with, you know, lamps, headlamps, going to the summit. I never got any altitude sickness, never felt it bad at all. In fact, I didn't even have to take any of those pills. But, you know, out of the 54 plus 9, out of the 63 people who started, you know, we only had 4 guides and all nine of us made it, you know, so 13 people on the top. So it was about teamwork. It was about your role, and it was about being grateful. So that's what I learned.
So I want to go to the next question that I have, and this is something that I'm still trying to figure out myself, like how you teach people this. But, you know, in our line of work, right, getting outside of your comfort zone, which is something that you did in Africa, obviously, is required in order to grow, right? We only grow outside of our comfort zone. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, right? But how do you know when you are just outside of your comfort zone versus being in over your head with something? And I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, we don't know how to gauge that. And when we go after something that where we are in over our head, it creates so much frustration. We want to, I don't know if you've read The Talent Code with Daniel Coyle, where No. He talks about being in the, you would love it. He talks about being in the sweet spot.
Yeah.
And the sweet spot is that place that's just outside our comfort zone where we're having some success, but we're also being challenged. If we're not in the sweet spot, things are, and we're in our comfort zone, everything is too easy. And then it becomes boring and we end up quitting. If we're too far out of our comfort zone, we get so frustrated because we're not having any success at all. And we're also going to quit when we're in that space. So how do we, you know where we're at and then to stay in that sweet spot? Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, 100%. So for me, it's very simple. It's when the little hairs start to stand up on the back of your neck, okay? And I've had that flying a jet, you know? I've had that riding my Harley. I've had that in business meetings. For me, it's very simple. When I start to get that awareness of the little hairs standing up on the back of my neck, I go, wow, okay. You know, I'm outside of my comfort zone. There's something that's causing that awareness. But it's to me, that's okay. See, I like to define that as being scared, but not afraid. And this is what I guess my guidance would be to somebody is I'm scared all the time. I don't mind being scared, but I don't ever want to be afraid. And to me, fear is what stops people, right? So when you get to that comfort zone, as you were describing, when you're too far out there, you will feel fear. And to me, that's a force. Feels like a force coming at you, and you feel like it's out of your control, and that's actually a misperception, right? So what I try to do is I call nibbling the envelope. I did this in an F-18 when I flew up to 57,000 feet. I do it when I'm riding race cars or driving motorcycles. You never go to that 100% limit, okay? Because the minute you touch that, all right, you got to back off. because you can't stay on that edge. I call it, you know, the nibbling the envelope, right? It's called an envelope in the airplane, is how high and fast can a jet go. It's based on thrust and drag and different parameters, right? And so when you're on that edge, you have to be very aware, because if you bust it, then you're going to, you know, something bad's going to happen. So I touch the envelope and I back off. I touch the envelope and I back off. I touch the envelope and I back off. And I'm constantly doing that in business and life too.
I think that's a great distinction. And that's number one. It goes back to some of the stuff we were talking about before with meditation, is cultivating enough self-awareness to actually be aware in the moment while you are engaged in this task and be able to operate between that focused awareness and the open awareness to know where your edge is at, and then being able to go back and forth between those. And I think that's a good way to put it, from the standpoint that if you're feeling fear, you've gone too far. If you're feeling discomfort, you're in the right spot. If you're bored, you're definitely got to take another step to get outside of that comfort zone, which I think that's an awesome answer. Last question. So many of us are leading ourselves or our organizations through a ton of adversity, change, and disruption right now. What are some things that you would advise leaders to implement as they are taking their organization to the other side of this pandemic?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about it earlier, but I like to talk about how you lead through change. And the first thing I would do is this idea of respond versus react. Okay, so when you're feeling change, it's uncomfortable, right? And so to me, it's like when I would fly through turbulence with the jets, you know, all six of us. If we hit turbulence, you know, the jets are going to move around. If we all reacted quickly, we'd probably hit each other. So we actually told ourselves that in turbulence, we're going to fly through it together. So that's a good metaphor for a leader. But we're also going to dampen our response, okay? And I've noticed that is true in organizations. You know, the way you lead through change is you have a process, you have the mindset, but you need to respond versus react. And then I go back to the thing I said earlier, which is connect, align, commit. You know, when you're going through change, we got to stay connected, we have to align, and we commit. And those things are constantly evolving. It's not like we do it once. We're doing it constantly throughout the organization. And right now, that seems to be working.
I think that's such an important point. And I wanted to let you end on this, but I think I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, around implementing a practice or a belief system around impermanence, right? And I know that's probably something that you practice with some of your spiritual practices you've been in. How can we adopt that belief as we are leading through this leading through change, leading through this disruption? I think, you know, we get so stuck when we resist the change, but in reality, everything is constantly in flux and changing. It's just going faster than we've ever had to experience before. And when we resist it, when we resist the change, that's when we suffer, right? So speak to that a little bit, and speak to the practice of impermanence, which I know you are familiar with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I love that you brought that up. You know, the first law of the universe is things change. I mean, that's just the law, right? And a lot of us, we fight that because, you know, change can necessarily be bad, but actually change can be good. I've noticed that in my life, change is one of the most positive things that I have. I think the biggest thing that I've learned how to overcome impermanence is that the world is coming from us, not at us. So that idea of a belief that, you know, what I'm perceiving, is this coming this way, which means, you know, I don't have control over the situation, or is it coming from me? And the more that you dive into that, you realize that a lot of what you're seeing out there is coming from the seeds that we plant ourselves, right? So that actually gives you a lot of power, because you can look inward for the answers, not looking outward. And to me, you know, that's the key. That's what I, and it's not easy though, because it means you're accountable. You're responsible for everything in your life.
That could be a whole nother episode, but we'll end it there. John, thank you so much for jumping on the show. It was good to see you. And I hope that everything keeps going well for you as you get to the other side of COVID.
Mike, great to be with you again. Thanks for making such a difference on other people's lives. You know, we're both out there helping people make a difference. So thank you very much. Glad to see you again.
Thanks, John.
What's up, guys? Thanks for taking the time to listen to the show today. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating on iTunes because it's how we spread the word about the show. Also, remember to grab your copy of Locked In, a digital guide on how to unlock world-class resilient performance by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. We'll see you next week. I'm always a winner, even if I fall, I can still get bigger. The definition of a champion, definition of a champion, no. Never for titles, but for survival, the champion. I've seen role players even with...